This is a People First Radio podcast.
The Alzheimer's Society of BC says dementia remains the health crisis Canadians avoid. The organization cites Leger data suggesting that a quarter of Canadians say they would rather not know if they had dementia. January is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. This past year saw Health Canada conditionally approve a new drug to slow the progression of early-stage Alzheimer's. I reached out to the Alzheimer's Society of BC to better understand the significance of that development and to talk about Alzheimer's Awareness Month.
I'm Dr. Heather Cook, and I am the Manager of Research and Knowledge Mobilization here at the Alzheimer's Society of BC.
And it is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Why the need for an Alzheimer's Awareness Month?
So here in British Columbia, there's approximately 85,000 people who live with dementia, and that could be due to Alzheimer's disease, could be due to one of the, you know, number of other dementias. But this is the month where the Alzheimer's Society of BC and our counterparts across the country really want people who are affected by dementia to know that they're not alone. So we are sharing the experiences during the month of January of people who are affected by dementia, who found meaning, who found connection and joy after a dementia diagnosis, in part by connecting with us here at the Society.
Could you maybe explain to me what discriminatory behavior against people with dementia looks like, how it manifests itself?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things is that we still see this prevalence of stigma, and that can be stigma from others, but it can also be self-stigma. So we know that silence and stigma can delay diagnosis, it can limit access to support, and it can worsen outcomes for people living with dementia and their care partners. So for example, we know that one in four Canadians, based on a recent poll, would rather not know if they had dementia, and many feel afraid to tell others. So whenever we're talking about something that pertains to our brain that perhaps is not a visible diagnosis, like some of the other conditions that people may live with here in British Columbia, you know, that becomes more of an issue.
What would you say to those one in four people who suggest that they wouldn't want to know that they're experiencing this in order to suggest that maybe it would help in some way?
Yeah, well, I think these days we have more treatments coming on the market. So, for example, back in October, the end of October, Health Canada issued an approval, a conditional approval for lecanemab, which is kind of the first new treatment in a couple of decades to address, to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. But what's central to the success of that treatment is an early diagnosis. So when we experience that stigma or that self-stigma, or we're reluctant to seek out that diagnosis from a care provider, when we sort of bury our head a little bit and say, you know, we'd prefer not to know, it's not necessarily the same diagnosis that someone may have lived with 30 years ago. Like, there are treatments available, there are supports available for people. And I think, coming back to what I said, you know, as we started our conversation, is that, you know, people are able to find meaning, people are able to find connection, there are moments of joy with a dementia diagnosis. And so I think we really need to start to move past that and to think about how we build community and how we provide support to those around us who are on this journey.
You talked about the drug lecanemab, which later on in 2025 received approval from Health Canada. What do you think people need to know about the broad strokes of what it does and what it means that it got this approval?
Yeah, but I think the approval of lecanemab, definitely an important milestone for Canadians who live with early stage Alzheimer's disease. So a couple of things. It's not a cure. We are still, lots of research occurring around that. But what this does do is that it slows the progression of the disease. So over a period of time, and the research that's been conducted in this area, it's about a 4-year period that we have data for. And the gap between folks who were in the treatment group, so folks who were taking lecanemab, and those who were not, but were who were a matched control group. Well, after those 4 years on the drug, participants had the same cognitive function as those at 36 months who were not on the drug. So, in other words, being on the drug slowed the progression of the disease by about 10 to 12 months over a 4-year period. And so that's time for people to spend a little longer in the workforce, to spend time with their families, to take a trip that they've been wanting to take. It's the difference between moving from being independent in the activities of daily living, with managing finances, to being more dependent on someone in those activities of daily life. So it's a really key milestone in that sense. But at the same time, it's a drug that's not for everyone. So it is designed to be administered to people who are in the very early stages of the disease process. And by disease, I mean specifically Alzheimer's disease. So dementia is an umbrella term, a collection of symptoms that's due to a variety of underlying diseases, one of which is Alzheimer's disease. So this particular drug works for people who live with Alzheimer's disease, and that's because it targets the plaques and the tangles that can build up in our brain. So the really considered the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. And so what lecanemab does over time, it removes or helps attack that buildup of plaque within the brain. So again, coming back to what we were saying earlier about that importance of that early diagnosis, because the treatment has the best effects for those who are in those early stages of the disease.
The drug received approval from Health Canada. What do you think people need to know about how or when they might be able to access it? And also, what do you think people need to be aware of when it comes to the cost of the drug and the potential side effects?
Right. So three great points in there, Joe. So the first around, what do they need to know in terms of how one might access the drug? So we know that when approval comes from Health Canada, it takes about 6 to 8 months before we see the drug become available in terms of extended health plans. So folks who have drug coverage through an organization like Sun Life or benefits through Pacific Blue Cross, for example, here in British Columbia. So that's the first step. The second would be if it receives approval from and coverage from each provincial formulary. So here in BC, Pharmacare would make that decision about whether they are going to reimburse for the drug out of the public purse. And that decision takes about 12 to 18 months. So we're still a bit of a ways away from finding out whether this drug will become available sort of more widespread. Of course, individuals who are willing to pay out of pocket, those will be the first individuals who are able to access the drug. But the drug, as you say, in terms of cost, is not cheap. We still don't know what the cost will be here in Canada. I'm not sure that the drug maker has actually released that information yet. But we do know in the US, the drug is about $26,500 per year in US dollars. So, if we do that conversion, that's somewhere around $34,000-$35,000 Canadian. So it's certainly not a cheap drug. And of course, where we sit here at the Alzheimer's Society of BC, we believe strongly in that equity of access to the medication. So, in that sense, approval is really only the first step. So we know that testing and treatment isn't yet publicly covered across the country. So we're waiting for the Canadian Drug Agency to make a decision, and I think that's coming possibly in mid to late February about whether it should be paid for by the government. And then after that, each province and territory will decide on that pricing and coverage.
If the drug were to become widely accessible and we're in a hypothetical scenario where the finances aren't a big concern for someone, what do you think they would need to know about the potential side effects of it?
In terms of the side effects for the drugs, there's a couple of side effects that are particularly noted with this drug, and they are known as ARIA-E and ARIA-H. And what that refers to is simply brain swelling and brain bleed within the brain. And we know that certain individuals are at higher risk for those side effects, and those aren't insignificant side effects. Although they typically will occur in the first couple months of the disease, and monitoring through MRIs can kind of catch it quite early. But for individuals who have a particular gene, and that's the APOE4 gene, seem to be at greater risk for developing some of these side effects. Now, the APOE4 gene is what we would call a susceptibility gene for dementia. So we have a couple of variations of the gene. There's APOE2, there's APOE3, and there's APOE4. So APOE2 seems to reduce the potential for someone to develop Alzheimer's disease later in life. APOE3 is sort of risk neutral, so it doesn't seem to make a difference one way or the other. And then APOE4, as I said, tends to increase the risk of someone developing Alzheimer's disease later in life. Now, there are lots of people who go on to develop Alzheimer's disease who don't have a copy of the APOE4 gene. And there are people who have the APOE4 gene, one or two copies, who don't go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. So that's why we say it's a susceptibility gene. And so what Health Canada has done, because people who have two copies of that gene, so we get one copy of that gene from each parent. So folks who have two copies, because they are at that significantly higher risk for those side effects, they are not eligible to receive lecanemab. So they're excluded from that Health Canada approval. So that means only people who have one or no copies of the APOE4 gene are eligible to take lecanemab.
You're listening to People First Radio. January is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. I'm speaking with Heather Cook from the Alzheimer's Society of BC about some recent developments around Alzheimer's treatment. Here is some information on the condition from HealthLink BC. Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia that damages the brain. It causes a steady loss of memory and of how well you can speak, think, and do your daily activities. The disease gets worse over time, but how quickly this happens varies. Some people lose the ability to do daily activities in the first few years. Others may do fairly well until much later in the disease. Mild memory loss is common in people older than 60. It may not mean that you have Alzheimer's disease. But if your memory is getting worse, see your doctor. If it is Alzheimer's, treatment may help. The average amount of time a person lives after getting symptoms of Alzheimer's disease is 8 to 10 years. That information is from HealthLink BC. Now back to my conversation with Heather Cook of the Alzheimer's Society of BC. So, lecanemab has been approved by Health Canada. It's kind of in the pipeline. It's probably going to be about at least a year before it starts to become something that the people in the stage where this is useful to them can access. If we're maybe returning to anyone affected by Alzheimer's, if Alzheimer's becomes a thing in someone's life, either because they or a loved one are diagnosed, could you walk me through what the health system is likely to do for them and what they are likely going to have to sort of figure out on their own?
Absolutely. So the first thing that we'd want to know is whether someone actually has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And so that involves a visit with a healthcare provider If there's an eye to actually being diagnosed with an eye to receiving lecanemab, then that's probably a referral to a neurologist. And there's a bit of a backlog to see a neurologist in the, in this province, but that would be the first step, getting in to see the neurologist. They would do a clinical workup. They would, take a medical history. And what they're going to look for in that clinical workup, they'll send for some imaging to see whether those plaques and tangles are present in the brain. And there's also, you can send someone for a cerebral spinal fluid test, which is a spinal tap or lumbar puncture. And we're able to test whether those are the level of proteins in the cerebral spinal fluid in the CSF. So we can look and see whether someone has plaques and tangles without actually invasively looking at their brain. And that's really a huge step forwards because when I started in this field sort of 30 years ago, the only way we could actually definitively diagnose someone who lived with Alzheimer's disease was upon autopsy. So now we can do that through, as I say, cerebral spinal fluid. But we've also seen in the last year blood-based biomarkers come onto the market. So where you can have a blood sample taken and you can look at some of the disease pathology that might be evident in the blood. So physicians, the neurologists would kind of want to confirm that those plaques and tangles are present and then, have that confirmatory diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But they're then going to want to test for the APOE4 status and want to get a sense of, does someone actually have one or sort of zero, one or two copies of the gene? Because if they've got two copies of the gene, they're going to be ineligible for the drug. Then someone's going to want to have a baseline MRI. So because of these side effects that I mentioned, the brain bleeding, the brain swelling, the only way that that can kind of be tracked or monitored is via an MRI. So it has to be someone who can undergo multiple MRIs. So the first step would be to have that baseline MRI. So they kind of get a sense of how things look in the brain. And then I think there's over the course of the first year of treatment, there's another four MRIs that would be required. Again, just for that safety monitoring to make sure there's nothing untowards happening in the brain. The drug itself is not something that you can just take as a pill. It's actually requires an IV infusion. So it would require you going to an infusion clinic and every 2 weeks sitting there having the treatment infused. I think it takes about an hour. And then you're going back until you hit 12 months. And then at 12 months, you can switch to maintenance dosing. So you can reduce from twice a month dosing to once a month dosing. So when you think about the systemic issues that might kind of evolve here. So we know that if you're living in a rural and remote area, it's going to be much harder for you to access a neurologist for that initial diagnosis. We know that it's going to be a little more challenging to access an infusion clinic. We know it's going to be challenging to access MRIs. For anyone who's tried to get an MRI in this province, we have a bit of a backlog. So we've got some work to do thinking about how do we address some of these systemic barriers for folks to ensure that people can readily access the drug when they need to.
You described a number of steps there. Is the system as it's set up right now, like, would it work for someone to go through all of the referrals and the diagnostic process and then be able to still receive this when it would be effective?
Yeah, and I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, right? Is that we probably have some work to do to make sure that all of that can occur in an expedient manner so that we're still able to ensure that it's effective. And then that really does come back to kind of what we were saying at the outset in terms of the importance of that early diagnosis. So we really do encourage people, if you're noticing, some differences either in yourself or in a spouse or in a parent, really having that conversation with your healthcare provider, starting that conversation, because these days there are treatments that are potentially available. And even if there's not, a medical treatment available, even if it turns out that, you have two copies of the APOE4 gene, or you have a dementia that's not Alzheimer's disease, what are some of the things that you can do? Well, here at the Society, we offer a suite of programs and supports for people who are affected by dementia. So folks who live with it and their care partners and their families. So coffee and chat groups, support groups. We offer social and fitness programs, Minds in Motion. And we have a dementia helpline that's accessible Monday to Fridays from 9 to 6 p.m. And that dementia helpline is also available in Punjabi, in Hindu, in Urdu, in Cantonese, and in Mandarin. And folks can call the DHL, the dementia helpline. That number is 1-800-936-6033. So again, that's 1-800-936-6033. And then I would also say there are other steps that we can do to kind of ensure we're doing the best we can to kind of support our brain health. And so we know that there are a number of factors that have been identified as risk factors for dementia. These include things like hearing loss. So if you're someone who lives with hearing loss, ensuring that you are wearing your hearing aids, right? If you have high LDL cholesterol, which is the bad cholesterol, having that conversation with a physician, ensuring that you're maintaining healthy cholesterol levels. That if you are struggling with depression, that's a key risk factor for dementia. So again, ensuring that you're having those conversations, taking those steps to ensure that you're treating your depression, being physically active, reducing or quitting smoking, managing your diabetes, managing hypertension, watching your alcohol consumption. These are all things that all of us can do to kind of support our brain health. And I think it's important as we talk about medications that are coming down the pipeline that we still kind of keep some of these other pieces in mind that we can all take steps to address those factors, perhaps in a and an easier way than we can, and when we're looking at drugs like lecanemab.
Are there myths out there about Alzheimer's that have spread that you'd like to take the chance to address?
Well, I think the number one would be that, and we hear this so often, oh, that's just mom getting older, or, well, I am 85, or I am 75, or insert the age there. And I think it's important to emphasize that memory loss is not a normal part of aging, and I would say that's probably one of the largest misconceptions. And so again, if you're noticing that memory loss in yourself or a partner or a family member, taking those steps to investigate that, because memory loss can also be caused by a number of other conditions, some of which may be reversible. So it's so important to have that conversation with a healthcare provider.
Could you give me a better sense of what kind of memory loss you're talking about there, and when it's something to be concerned about, and when, everyone loses their keys once in a while?
Yeah, and I think that that's a great example, that loss of keys. So I am notorious for losing my keys, but if I think about it, I can retrace my steps. I can be like, okay, I walked in the door, I had a conversation, with a family member. Oh, that's right, I put my keys down there. But for someone who lives with mild cognitive impairment, or Alzheimer's disease or vascular dementia or any one of the other dementias, they could think and think until the cows came home, and they're not necessarily going to be able to retrace their steps and remember where those keys are, right? So in Alzheimer's disease, we know that some of the first changes that occur within the brain are within the hippocampus, and that's the area of our brain that's responsible for short-term memories. So, we would see things like someone forgetting the name of a close friend or neighbor. When you're out on the street and you run into someone and not being able to remember who that individual is. We hear from people that all of a sudden one day they may be driving home from work and they can't quite remember the route. And yet it's a route that they have driven or walked for a number of years. It could be challenges with finances. So you may notice that, someone has paid a bill multiple times because they've forgotten that they've paid it. So those are some of the things that those are common things that we might see.
Is there anything on the horizon other than some of the lecanemab developments we've talked about so far? Any kind of new and contemporary developments related to Alzheimer's you'd like to let people know about?
Well, we're awaiting a decision from Health Canada for a second treatment for Alzheimer's disease that works in a similar manner to lecanemab, and that's called donanemab. So, sometime in the new year, we're expecting that decision. There's also so much research that is occurring within the province, within our country, and really globally around kind of brain health. We know that females or people who are assigned female at birth are more likely to live with dementia than those assigned male. And so it's about two-thirds of people who live with dementia are people assigned female at birth. And so we're starting to kind of get a better understanding of like why is that? What are the roles that hormones might play in that? What is the role of menopause in brain health? So there's some really exciting developments, I think, coming down the pipeline in terms of improving on understanding of what causes it, which then can help us have a better sense of how we might treat it. I also think the blood-based biomarkers is a really exciting development. So, as I mentioned earlier, typically, if we want a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease pathology, often there'll be a lumbar puncture that will be done, and you'll look at the level of proteins in the cerebrospinal fluid. But now, to simply be able to have a blood draw and then to be able to look at the blood and to determine the presence of those proteins in the blood is so much less invasive and is really key when we think about kind of that widespread uptake and access for lecanemab.
It's Alzheimer's Awareness Month. You've talked about the idea that there is this stigma out there against Alzheimer's and against dementia in general. And you've talked about the idea that it's important to not let that stigma prevent you from maybe seeking help and seeking care. Is there anything else you think it's important for people to know about that idea? Or is there anything that people who maybe, they're not directly impacted by this right now that they can do to not sort of further that stigma?
Yeah, well, there's a myriad of ways to become involved. So anyone can learn more about dementia and then share that knowledge like within their networks, within their community. We have an Alzheimer's Awareness Month toolkit that can be downloaded from our website. Folks can share that knowledge again within their network and their community. And then we can raise awareness about dementia by, encouraging people to share their personal experiences through social media challenges. So folks can visit our website, which is altsbc.org or alzbc.org, and all of those resources will be there on the website for folks to access. And I think I probably would say, really anyone can call the FirstLink Dementia Helpline to ask questions about dementia at any time. We've got knowledgeable, empathetic staff at the other end who are there to help guide callers to the education, to the resources, to the programs, and the services they need. And I think really, the message that I would leave folks with is that with support, people can continue to find that joy, find that meaning, and find that connection on the dementia journey. So, really, no one should have to, travel this road alone. And while we know there's no roadmap for living with dementia, here at the Alzheimer's Society of BC, we can be your guide.
Heather Cook is Manager of Research and Knowledge Mobilization at the Alzheimer's Society of BC.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.